around her neck twice and tied it very tightly in a double overhand knot. After Brenda had made her final desperate attempt to flee and then passed out on the kitchen floor, Ricky Knapp and Chip Carnes, still outside in the car, heard nothing more from inside the duplex. The silence scared Carnes, who told Knapp to get in the driver's seat and then commanded, "Let's get out of here." Knapp started the car and backed out of the driveway, but then lost his nerve. "I can't leave them," he told Carnes. He parked the Impala on the street in front of the apartment and waited while Carnes slouched out of sight in the back seat. After tying the vacuum cord around Brenda's neck, Dan says, "I went into the front room and picked up the knife. Then I walked down the hall, being led by the spirit, because I didn't know the layout of the house or which room was the baby's. The first door I opened was where the baby was. She was standing there in the corner of her crib. I walked in. I closed the door behind me for privacy. I think the baby thought I was her father because I had a beard and Alan had a beard at that time. And we have identical voices. I spoke to her for a minute. I told her, 'I'm not sure what this is all about, but apparently it's God's will that you leave this world. Perhaps we can talk about it later.' And then I set my hand on her head, put the knife under her chin like this, and I just..." Pausing in his monologue, Lafferty uses his manacled hands to matter-of-factly demonstrate how he pulled the razor-sharp butcher's knife so forcefully across Erica's neck that he very nearly decapitated her. Afterward, all that held the baby's head to her tiny body were a few thin shreds of skin and tendon. "I closed my eyes," he continues, "so I didn't see what I was doing. I didn't hear anything." Lafferty shares the details of Erica's murder in a preternaturally serene voice, as if he were recounting a trip to a hardware store. "Then I walked down the hall into the bathroom and washed the blood off the knife. I didn't feel anything. At the time, I didn't even know if I had really killed Erica. Not until later, when they showed me the pictures of the crime scene. I'm pretty sure she didn't suffer. Maybe I believe that just to make myself feel better. I don't know. But hopefully the knife was so sharp she didn't feel any pain. Anyway, I washed the knife off. And when the knife was clean, I walked into the kitchen and stood over Brenda. Straddling her, I untied the cord and took it off her neck. I grabbed her by the hair, placed the knife against the side of her neck, and drew it across her throat. Again, I closed my eyes, so I didn't actually see anything. But this time I could hear the blade cut through the trachea and feel it hit the bone of her spinal column. Then I walked back into the bathroom and washed off the knife a second time, turned to Ron and said, "Okay, we can leave now." Ron and Dan walked out the back door and returned to the car. When Knapp and Carnes saw the brothers' blood-soaked clothing, Dan says, they kind of freaked out. Carnes especially started to come apart. Frightened by the overpowering smell of blood in the car, Carnes grabbed Dan's shirt and demanded hysterically, "You need to get rid of that smelly thing." "When he said that," Dan remembers, "I thought to myself, hey, it's not even over yet. Why should I change my clothes now? We still have two other residences to visit." But Dan obliged Carnes all the same. As the Impala pulled away from the apartment, Dan removed his bloody shirt, borrowed a clean shirt from Carnes, and put it on. Ron, too, was extremely agitated, but Dan remained calm and unruffled. "I was completely comfortable that things had happened the way God intended them to happen." Ron was very shaken and very weak. He kept talking about the smell of blood on his hands. I put my hand on his shoulder and tried to comfort him. As they drove, Ron seemed to regain some of his composure. Guiding the Impala through the thick July heat, taking care not to exceed the speed limit, he knew exactly where he was going. Highland, the next town to the north, where he and Diana and their children used to live, and where Chloe Lowe still lived. 4 months earlier, God had instructed Ron, "It is my will and commandment that ye remove the following individuals in order that my work might go forward. First, thy brother's wife Brenda and her baby, then Chloe Lowe, then Richard Stowe, and it is my will that they be removed in rapid succession." With the murders of Brenda and Erica, the first half of the revelation had been fulfilled. As they drove the short distance to Lowe's home, Ron and Dan talked about how they would carry out the rest of it. Following the commandment as closely as possible, they intended to first remove Low, then Stow, executing them in rapid succession before the day was out. Although the brothers agreed that killing Low should be easy because she was a small woman, Ron confessed to Dan, I'm afraid I don't have the energy if we have to take the life of Chloe Low. You're worrying about things you shouldn't worry about, Dan assured him. I'll take care of that, just like I've taken care of this, because it's the Lord's business. Part 3. The best fruits of religious experience are the best things that history has to show. The highest flights of charity, devotion, trust, patience, bravery to which the wings of human nature have spread themselves have been flown for religious ideals. William James, The Varieties of Religious Experience. One is often told that it is a very wrong thing to attack religion, because religion makes men virtuous. So I am told. I have not noticed it. You find as you look around the world that every single bit of progress in humane feeling, every improvement in the criminal law, every step toward the diminution of war, every step toward better treatment of the colored races, or every mitigation of slavery, every moral progress that there has been in the world has been consistently opposed by the organized churches of the world. My own view on religion is that of Lucretius. I regard it as a disease born of fear and as a source of untold misery to the human race. I cannot, however, deny that it has made some contributions to civilization. It helped in early days to fix the calendar, and it caused Egyptian priests to chronicle eclipses with such care that in time they became able to predict them. These two services I am prepared to acknowledge, but I do not know of any others. Bertrand Russell, Why I Am Not a Christian, and Other Essays on Religion and Related Subjects. Chapter 17. Exodus. They went in bitterness and in hope. The persecutions, the massacres, the martyrdom of the prophet, the bloody flux and the black canker and desolate graves had cemented them into a unit, and every successive wagon train for many years was like new flight out of Egypt. The Old Testament parallel was like a bugle in the brain. Some of them probably even hoped for a pursuing Pharaoh and a dividing of waters. They had found their strength. Mormonism in Exodus was a herd, like a herd of buffalo, and its strength was the herd's strength and the cunning of the tough old bulls who ran the show. Brigham Young was no seer and revelator, but a practical leader, an organizer and colonizer of very great stature. Wallace Stegner, Mormon Country. As dawn began to brighten the eastern sky, Porter Rockwell, the destroying angel, Joseph Smith's staunch bodyguard and enforcer, hurtled toward Nauvoo at full gallop, seething with rage. It was June 28, 1844. 12 hours earlier, the Mormon prophet had been shot dead in the Carthage jail by a band of Illinois militiamen, despite Governor Thomas Ford's personal promise that Joseph would be protected from harm. When Rockwell reached Nauvoo, he shouted the grim news as he rode through the streets of the waking city. Joseph is killed. They have killed him. God damn them, they have killed him. The saints reacted to Joseph's death with woe and staggering grief, vowing through their tears to exact revenge. First, however, they had to address a more pressing concern, the survival of Mormonism. The 10,000 mourners filing through Joseph's mansion to pay their respects and view his corpse despaired over who among the living would be able to lead the church through the months of critical peril that loomed. As distinguished historian D. Michael Quinn noted in his book, The Mormon Hierarchy, Origins of Power, institutionally, Mormonism faced a dilemma of paramount consequence at Smith's death in June 1844. Can the church survive without the founding prophet? Like the removal of a keystone from an arch, would the entire structure collapse? Joseph had neglected to provide his followers with a clear mechanism for determining his successor. Indeed, over the years, he had hinted at various conflicting criteria for the transfer of power. The result, owing to his untimely demise, was a leadership vacuum that several would-be prophets scrambled to fill. Among the leading claimants were Joseph's eldest son, Joseph Smith III, who was only 11 years old when his father was killed, and whom the prophet probably intended to be his successor when the boy became an adult. Joseph's younger brother, Samuel H. Smith. Sidney Rigdon, the influential theologian whom Joseph had picked as his vice presidential running mate in his 1844 campaign for the United States presidency, despite the fact that Rigdon, who suffered from nervous spasms and swoonings, was emotionally erratic and unreliable. Brigham Young, the stalwart, ambitious president of the church's Quorum of the Twelve Apostles. The contenders fell into two camps. Those bitterly opposed to polygamy, who saw Joseph's death as an opportunity to eradicate the practice before it gained traction, and those who had already taken plural wives and regarded polygamy as a divinely ordained principle that must be sustained. Joseph had first come forward with his covert revelation sanctioning celestial marriage scarcely a year before his martyrdom, and even after he documented the revelation in writing, only a select group of his most trusted cronies had been let in on the secret. During the bleak, chaotic days that followed Joseph's murder, 95% of Mormons still had no clue that their prophet had married more than one wife and had declared plural marriage to be one of the most crucial keys to gaining entry to the kingdom of heaven. Emma Smith, Samuel Smith, Sidney Rigdon, William Law, and others who despised polygamy, committed Mormons who were convinced that it would be the ruin of their church, desperately wanted to install a successor to Joseph who would revoke the doctrine before it took hold. On July 13th, Emma warned that if the next leader of the Mormons is not a man she approves of, she will do the church all the injury she can. Apostles John Taylor, Willard Richards, Brigham Young, and their brethren in the pro-polygamy camp wanted just as desperately to install a prophet who would uphold the doctrine, lest the plural wives these men had covertly married be branded as whores. The succession crisis was further complicated by the fact that 10 members of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, including Brigham Young, were roaming far afield during the spring of 1844, having been dispatched across the nation by Joseph to drum up support for his bid to become president of the United States. Young, who was in Massachusetts when Joseph was shot, didn't learn about the prophet's death until 19 days after the fact. Crushed by the news, Brigham initially despaired that without Joseph, the Mormon church would surely disintegrate. "My head felt so distressed," he lamented, "I thought it would crack." As soon as they heard of the assassination, Brigham and the rest of the apostles rushed back to Nauvoo with the utmost haste. The anti-polygamy camp maneuvered furiously to have one of their own confirmed as prophet before the full Quorum of the 12 Apostles had a chance to return to Nauvoo from various distant corners of the Republic. Young Joseph Smith III had the most legitimate claim to the throne, but because he had not yet even reached puberty, the anti-polygamists focused their energies on giving the job to the departed prophet's younger brother, Samuel H. Smith, instead. On July 30th, however, just as it was looking as if he had the job locked up, Samuel abruptly died. Compelling circumstantial evidence suggests that he succumbed from poison administered by Hosea Stout, the chief of the Nauvoo police, who was loyal to Brigham Young and the other polygamists. Following Samuel Smith's suspect death, Sidney Rigdon, another anti-polygamist, launched a frantic last-ditch effort to grab Joseph's mantle before Brigham and the other apostles arrived back in Nauvoo. Hurriedly securing the support of others in the anti-polygamy faction, he successfully maneuvered to have himself appointed guardian of the church, although the appointment wouldn't be official until it could be confirmed by a vote at a special church-wide gathering scheduled for August 8th. It appeared to be a fait accompli, until Brigham Young and the rest of the apostles suddenly showed up on the night of August 6th, just in time to put the brakes on the anti-polygamist scheme to install Rigdon as Joseph's replacement. On the morning of August 8th, 1844, the faithful of Nauvoo assembled to hear Rigdon and Young each explain why he should be the new Mormon leader. Rigdon argued his case for 90 minutes with passion, but failed to persuade his fellow saints that he was God's clear choice for the job. Then it was Brigham's turn to address the crowd, and an astonishing thing was said to have occurred, leaving no doubt about who would be the next prophet. "Brigham Young arose and roared like a young lion," recalled John D. Lee, imitating the style and voice of Joseph the prophet. Many of the brethren declared that they saw the mantle of Joseph fall upon him. I myself at the time imagined that I saw and heard a strong resemblance to the prophet in him, and felt that he was the man to lead us. Numerous saints who witnessed Brigham's address, and even greater numbers who didn't, swore that he underwent an incredible transfiguration as he spoke, temporarily assuming the voice, the appearance, and even the physical stature of Joseph, who was a considerably taller man. After such a performance, Brigham had no trouble convincing most of those present that he should be their next leader, and thus did he become the Mormons' second president, prophet, seer, and revelator. It is interesting to speculate about what would have happened had Brigham's return to Nauvoo been delayed 36 hours, which might have allowed Rigdon to commandeer the helm of the church. One can safely assume that Mormon culture, to say nothing of the culture of the American West, would be vastly different today. In all likelihood, the Mormons would never have settled the Great Basin, and LDS polygamy would have died in the cradle. As Rigdon's own son John observed, the Latter-day Saints made no mistake in placing Brigham Young at the head of the church. If Sidney Rigdon had been chosen to take that position, the church would have tottered and fallen. Like Joseph Smith, Brigham Young had been born poor in rural New England, where the brouhaha of the Second Great Awakening made a lasting imprint on his consciousness. He was baptized into the Mormon Church in 1832 at the age of 31, and quickly became one of Joseph's most loyal lieutenants. Brigham's devotion to the founding prophet was deep and unswerving. He believed wholeheartedly in even Joseph's most extreme theological tenets. He may well have believed in them with greater conviction than Joseph himself did. Brigham was, however, Joseph's opposite in almost every imaginable way. Joseph was tall, athletic, and handsome. Brigham was short and thick. At his heaviest, he weighed more than 250 pounds, with small, porcine eyes. Joseph was emotional, charismatic, an impulsive dreamer, and incorrigible charmer. Brigham was steady, dependable, and pragmatic to a fault, a brilliant organizer who thought things through and paid attention to the details. Joseph craved the adoration of his followers. Brigham didn't ask the saints to love him. He demanded only their respect and unconditional obedience. Joseph conversed constantly with God and in his lifetime received 135 revelations that were canonized in the Doctrine and Covenants, as well as many dozens more that were never published. Brigham had only a single canonized revelation, D&C 136, which characteristically had nothing to do with sacred mysteries. It simply specified how the Mormons should organize their wagon trains for their migration to Utah. To be sure, nobody ever called Brigham a religious genius, but when the Mormons faced imminent extermination in the wake of Joseph's martyrdom, religious genius wasn't what they needed. Instead, they required discipline and firm, decisive leadership, which is what Brigham ably provided. George Bernard Shaw praised him as the American Moses. He was the right man at the right time. In May 1845, 9 men were indicted for the murders of Joseph and Hiram Smith, 7 of whom were brought to trial in Carthage. Among the defendants in People v. Levi Williams, as the case was designated, were some of Western Illinois' leading personages, including a colonel, a major, and 2 captains in the Carthage Grays, an Illinois state senator, and the editor of the Warsaw newspaper. Given the virulent anti-Mormon feelings throughout Hancock County, bringing the guilty to justice wasn't going to be easy. Adding to the likelihood that no convictions would be forthcoming, both John Taylor and Willard Richards, the Mormon apostles who'd witnessed the murders, announced that they refused to appear in court, fearing, with good reason, that if they came anywhere near Carthage, they would immediately be killed. The trial was held regardless. On May 30th, to nobody's astonishment, all 9 defendants were found not guilty. Although the Mormons expected this verdict, they were nevertheless infuriated by it. An editorial in the Nauvoo paper declared, "The murderers can rest assured that their case, independent of earthly tribunals, will be tried by the Supreme Judge of the universe, who has said, 'Vengeance is mine, and I will repay.'" A month later, on the first anniversary of Joseph Smith's death, Brigham spoke bitterly of the trial verdict and proclaimed that It belongs to God and his people to avenge the blood of his servants. Toward this end, he instructed church authorities to issue a formal oath of vengeance, which was immediately made part of the temple endowment ceremony, one of the church's most sacred rituals. The oath required Mormons to pledge, "I will pray and never cease to pray, and never cease to importune high heaven to avenge the blood of the prophets on this nation. And I will teach this to my children and my children's children unto the third and fourth generations." This solemn vow to take vengeance was recited by every Latter-day Saint who participated in the standard temple ritual until it was removed from the endowment ceremony in 1927, after the oath was leaked to the non-Mormon press, sparking an outcry from politicians and the Gentile public that it was treasonous. In the months following Joseph's murder, most residents of Nauvoo didn't need any prodding to seek revenge against Gentiles. Ever since the assassination, non-Mormons had stepped up their violent campaign to drive the Saints from Hancock County. Emboldened by the acquittal of Joseph's killers, throughout the summer of 1845, anti-Mormon vigilantes led by Levi Williams, the primary defendant in the murder trial, roamed the county setting fire to Mormon homes and farms. By September 15, 1845, 44 Mormon residences had been burned to the ground. On September 16th, Porter Rockwell was on his way to help a Mormon family salvage possessions from the ruins of one such incinerated home when he chanced upon Lieutenant Frank Worrell of the Carthage Greys, the same man who had been in charge of guarding the jail on the evening Joseph was murdered. Worrell had commanded the militiamen who'd conspired to fire blank cartridges at the approaching mob and had then stepped aside so the vigilantes could assassinate the prophet without impediment. When Rockwell encountered Worrell on that September afternoon, the latter was on horseback, chasing a local sheriff who'd had the temerity to express sympathy for the Mormons. As Worrell galloped after the terrified sheriff, Rockwell fired a rifle ball into Worrell's gut. The victim jumped 4 feet in the air, said a witness to the shooting, and rolled away from his horse dead. The killing of Worrell significantly worsened relations between the Saints and their adversaries. A few days later, a band of Mormons captured a youthful Gentile man named McBracking, whom they suspected of burning Mormon homes. McBracking begged for his life, but the Saints weren't in a forgiving mood. They castrated him, cut his throat, sliced off one of his ears, and shot him 2 or 3 times. As Joseph had preached 3 years earlier, some sins were so heinous that the only way the guilty party could atone for them was to spill his blood upon the ground and let the smoke thereof ascend up to God. By now, passions were at flash point on both sides of the conflict. Posses of enraged Mormons and Gentiles ranged back and forth across the county in a rampage of arson and plunder, burning more than 200 homes. Worried that Hancock County was again on the brink of full-blown civil war, Governor Thomas Ford dispatched 400 troops to Nauvoo, along with a committee of respected dignitaries, including renowned statesman Stephen A. Douglas, who were implored to negotiate a lasting solution to the hostilities. It had become clear to Brigham that there was no future for the Saints anywhere near Hancock County. On September 24th, he sent a letter to Governor Ford's Blue Ribbon Committee saying that in return for a ceasefire from the Gentiles, the Mormons would promise to vacate not only Illinois, but the whole of the United States. They would depart the following spring as soon as the prairie grass along their intended route west was high enough to provide forage for their beasts of burden. The Gentiles agreed to the deal on the 1st of October, giving the Saints a window of relative peace in which to build wagons and stockpile supplies in preparation for their mass evacuation. For the Saints' next homeland, Brigham Young wanted to find a place that was both a long way from civilization and would seem repugnant to Gentile settlers, so that his people might live free from persecution. After considering Oregon, California, and Canada's Vancouver Island, he and his counselors decided the Saints would make their final stand amid the sparsely inhabited deserts of the Great Basin, which at the time belonged to Mexico. The Saints didn't intend to abandon the city of Joseph until the weather warmed, but when news arrived that a warrant had been issued for Brigham's arrest on charges of harboring counterfeiters, an earlier departure suddenly seemed like a good idea. Nauvoo had long been a notorious haven for printers of bogus money, thanks to a highly unusual provision in the city charter granting the town leaders extraordinary powers of habeas corpus. This much-abused clause permitted Brigham, and Joseph before him, to provide legal immunity to individuals charged with crimes beyond the city limits. And like the residents of present-day Colorado City who see nothing wrong with bleeding the beast by committing welfare fraud, neither Brigham nor Joseph believed that the counterfeiters in their midst were criminals in the eyes of the Lord. They were, to the contrary, helping advance the kingdom of God every time they bilked a Gentile with their fraudulent greenbacks, and thus deserved to be protected from arrest. On February 4, 1846, the first platoon of Mormon emigrants boarded flatboats at the Nauvoo dock, rowed west across the dark, near-freezing waters of the Mississippi River, and clambered uncertainly onto the Iowa shore, which was still in the iron grip of winter. The Great Exodus was launched. Disillusioned by Joseph's murder as well as by disturbing rumors of clandestine debaucheries practiced by their leaders, hundreds of Mormons had split away from the church in the preceding months. After Sidney Rigdon's ambition to replace Joseph Smith was quashed by Brigham Young's ascendancy, Rigdon and a few hundred followers established a church of their own in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, but it quickly dwindled to nothing. Apostle Lyman Wright broke away with numerous unhappy Mormons to form another short-lived church in Texas, and a charismatic charlatan and one-time Baptist named James Jesse Strang drew 700 disenchanted saints away from Brigham's church, including Joseph's mother, his lone surviving brother, two of his sisters, and Martin Harris, the man who'd mortgaged his farm to pay for publication of the Book of Mormon. Strang attracted this following by pronouncing that an angel had visited him at the exact moment of the prophet's murder and anointed him Joseph's successor. 15 months later, Strang claimed to have discovered an ancient text titled the Book of the Law of the Lord, inscribed on a set of brass folios he called the Plates of Laban, which he found near Voree, Wisconsin, buried on a hillside. According to Strang, this document had originally been part of the set of gold plates unearthed by Joseph in 1827 that yielded the Book of Mormon. Impressed by these plates, the Strangites joined their prophet in establishing a colony on Beaver Island, off the northwest coast of Michigan's Lower Peninsula, where Strang had himself crowned King James I of the Kingdom of God on Earth, began taking plural wives, and ruled with absolute power. It was to be a brief reign, however. In 1856, a gang of disgruntled Beaver Island denizens ambushed King James and fatally shot him. Even before Strang's murder, moreover, several prominent Strangites who objected to the king's polygamous proclivities broke away to form the reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Joseph's widow, Emma Smith, joined these reorganites, and her son Joseph III became the group's president and prophet. Today, this church, now called the Community of Christ and headquartered in Independence, Missouri, in a striking $60 million temple designed by Gio Obata, has 250,000 members, making it by far the largest of the Mormon spin-off sects. But the overwhelming majority loaded up whatever possessions would fit into their wagons, abandoned the rest to their enemies, and followed Brigham into the wilderness. By May of that year, more than 6,000 saints were plodding westward through the axle-deep spring mud drawn by the promise of Zion. The 1,300-mile emigration from Nauvoo was a grueling trial. On the journey west, they were plagued with frostbite, diphtheria, scurvy, starvation, stillborn babies, tick fever, hostile Gentiles, and an epidemic of whooping cough that killed dozens of young children. More than 600 saints perished during that first grim winter. But Brigham proved to be a masterful manager of men, and he possessed a formidable will. On July 21, 1847, an advance party crested a ridge and caught the saints' first glimpse of the valley where the broad waters of the Great Salt Lake glistened in the sunbeams. The next morning, this group, with Scout Porter Rockwell leading the way, descended the western slope of the Wasatch down what is now called Emigration Canyon. At its mouth, they emerged into the saints' new Zion, near the southern end of the vast body of water they had spied earlier that day, a lake with no outlet and saltier than the Pacific Ocean. Although most of this bottomland was a relentlessly barren desert, along its eastern margin flowed streams of sweet, crystalline snowmelt that rushed down from the Wasatch Range through all seasons. These imposing granite mountains, moreover, served as a natural barrier that would help keep the godless at bay. All things considered, the Great Salt Lake Valley struck the scouting party as a fine site on which to erect a capital city for the kingdom of God on earth. After conducting a 2-hour tour of the immediate environs, they rode back up Emigration Canyon to share the joyous news with Brigham and their brethren. Brigham, weak and aching from tick fever, arrived in the valley with the main company of saints on July 24, 1847, the date now venerated throughout Mormondom as Pioneer Day, and the holiday Ron Lafferty would choose 137 years later on which to fulfill his removal revelation. Before the sun had set that first evening, they had planted a crop of potatoes and diverted the waters of City Creek to irrigate them. A stone's throw from the creek, they began laying the foundation for a temple at the center of what would become Salt Lake City. The long 17-year journey from Palmyra was over. The Mormons had finally found their home. Many had died en route, but those who survived the hardships and completed the exodus were more devoted to the church than ever. The wafflers and whiners, the doubters, the malcontents, those of weak faith, had been filtered out by the myriad trials of the preceding years, leaving behind the truest of the true believers. The grueling emigration from Nauvoo, on top of the violence directed at them in Missouri and Illinois, had forged an exceptional bond among the first waves of saints to arrive in Utah. Adversity had welded them into a close-knit tribe whose loyalty to their leader, Brigham Young, was unconditional. They would do whatever he asked of them. When the first wagon trains left Nauvoo in the bitter days of February 1846, only a handful of the emigrants knew anything about the doctrine of plural marriage, or that it was already being practiced by their leaders. 9 miles beyond the western banks of the Mississippi, safely beyond the reach of the murderous vigilantes who roamed the Illinois shore, the saints paused to regroup at Sugar Creek, Iowa, before continuing their trek to the Rocky Mountains. And there, in that snowbound camp, the sacred secret of polygamy was first shared openly with the rank and file. To the world beyond the confines of their tribe, however, Brigham Young and his counselors vigorously denied that Mormons engaged in polygamy, and they would continue to deny it for years to come, even after the Mormons were established in the Great Salt Lake Valley. Historian D. Michael Quinn refers to the saints' bald-faced dissembling as theocratic ethics. The Mormons called it lying for the Lord. Brigham once famously bragged, "We have the greatest and smoothest liars in the world." Their decision to keep polygamy in the closet was made necessary by the rapidly expanding boundaries of the American Empire. After 2 decades of the saints' difficult and often vicious relations with the United States, Brigham had moved his people outside the national borders to escape the strife. But scarcely a year after they landed in Utah, the American Republic followed the saints west and took possession of their new Zion. The Mormon homeland was annexed to the United States following the conclusion of the war with Mexico as part of the 1848 Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. This development greatly complicated Brigham's plan to establish a theocratic kingdom unfettered by Gentile laws. And the saints' grand dream of dominion over a vast chunk of the Great Basin was further imperiled when gold was discovered in California, prompting swarms of Gentile prospectors to stream through Salt Lake City, which became a crucial way station on the shortest route to the gold fields. The gold rush did have an upside. As the only game in town, Brigham was able to extort exorbitant prices from the Gentiles for provisions they needed to complete the long journey to California, giving the saints desperately needed capital. Following the annexation of Utah territory by the United States, Brigham, ever the pragmatist, proclaimed the Mormons' allegiance to the American Republic, then promptly petitioned Washington for statehood, which he considered the best way for the saints to secure some measure of sovereignty. After all that had happened in Nauvoo, however, officials in Washington were leery of giving Brigham autonomy, so the Mormons were granted territorial status for their homeland instead of statehood, which allowed Washington, in theory, to keep the Latter-day Saints on a much tighter leash. Utah Territory was formally established on September 9, 1850, with Brigham appointed governor. The Saints proposed naming the new territory Deseret, a neologism from the Book of Mormon meaning honeybee, which struck Brigham Young as an apt symbol of the Mormons' industry and their belief that personal freedom should yield to the welfare of the collective whole. But a skeptical Congress nixed this suggestion and named the territory Utah instead, after the Ute Indians who populated the region. Among themselves, nevertheless, the Mormons pointedly continued to call their homeland the Kingdom of Deseret, and it became the name they inscribed on all their maps. Today, the beehive remains prominent on the official state seal of Utah, as well as on road signs designating state highways. Additionally, the second biggest newspaper in Utah, which is owned by the LDS Church, is called the Deseret News. On February 4, 1851, the new governor finally felt secure enough about the Saints' prospects to come clean about the number of wives he had. "I have many," he boasted during an address to the territorial legislature, "and I am not ashamed to have it known." Brigham Young took at least 20 women as wives, perhaps as many as 57. He sired an estimated 57 children, and his direct descendants now number in the thousands. The most famous of them is Steve Young, Brigham's great-great-great-grandson, a star quarterback for both Brigham Young University and the San Francisco 49ers of the National Football League, and the Super Bowl MVP in 1995. It was his first public admission that Mormons practiced polygamy. A year later, he decided it was time to announce the peculiar doctrine to an even wider audience. On August 29, 1852, at a church-wide assembly in Salt Lake City, he told of Joseph Smith's 1843 revelation concerning celestial marriage, predicting that one day it would be fostered and believed in by the more intelligent portions of the world as one of the best doctrines ever proclaimed to any people. The cat was out of the bag. To Brigham's dismay, very quickly it proved to be a public relations disaster for the Mormon Church. In France and England, recently converted Mormons were shocked and appalled by the revelation. The once robust flow of fresh converts from Europe to Utah slowed to a trickle. A missionary reported that 1,776 British saints abandoned the church during the 6 months following the 1852 announcement. Most of the Utah Mormons, on the other hand, were amenable to the idea of plural marriage once it was made known to them. Although polygamy was never practiced by more than a minority of saints, it would have been hard to find many inhabitants of Deseret in the mid-1850s who didn't consider plural marriage a lofty ideal to which all righteous men and women should aspire. By 1855, polygamy was not only being practiced openly, it was being urged on the faithful with an unrelentingly hard sell that included dire warnings to the recalcitrant. "If any of you will deny the plurality of wives and continue to do so," Brigham threatened, "I promise that you will be damned." This adamant promotion of polygamy grew out of a white-hot burst of religious fanaticism known as the Mormon Reformation, which peaked in the years 1856 and 1857. As Will Bagley observed in his provocative, meticulously researched history, Blood of the Prophets, perhaps the most troubling aspect of the Reformation was the Mormon leadership's obsession with blood. Joseph Smith taught that certain grievous sins put sinners beyond the reach of the atoning blood of Christ. Their only hope was to have their own blood shed to atone. Of all the beliefs that laid the foundation of Utah's culture of violence, none would have more devastating consequences. The Reformation was spearheaded by the God-besotted Jedediah Grant, Brigham's immensely popular second counselor, whom the Saints affectionately called Jeddy, Brigham's sledgehammer. Grant explained to the Lord's chosen that they had the right to kill a sinner to save him when he commits those crimes that can only be atoned for by shedding his blood. In September 1856, he sermonized that there were sinners even then in their midst who needed to have their blood shed, for water will not do. Their sins are of too deep a dye. Grant preached as fervently about the Saints' duty to marry profusely as he did about blood atonement, and his aggressive campaign on behalf of plural marriage achieved the desired effect. Mormon men started taking on wives at a frantic rate. Apostle Wilford Woodruff observed in 1856, "All are trying to get wives until there is hardly a girl 14 years old in Utah but what is married or is just going to be." The saints readily accepted their prophet's avowal that plural marriage was a divinely ordained and crucially important doctrine. But Brigham had badly miscalculated how the rest of the Republic would react to the Mormons' embrace of polygamy. After the sacred doctrine became known outside of Utah, a nearly hysterical barrage of condemnation rained down on the saints from afar, a barrage that would continue unabated for half a century. Most Americans considered polygamy to be morally repugnant, even as they were secretly fascinated by it. These remarks from Congressman Joe Alexander McClernand of Illinois, speaking before the U.S. House of Representatives, are a fair characterization of the Gentile reaction to the Mormon doctrine. "As to polygamy, I charge it to be a crying evil, sapping not only the physical constitution of the people practicing it, dwarfing their physical proportions and emasculating their energies, but at the same time perverting the social virtues and vitiating the morals of its victims. It is a scarlet whore. It is a reproach to the Christian civilization and deserves to be blotted out." McClernand's remarks were almost certainly influenced by a pseudo-scientific study, patently preposterous, yet widely accepted by both the medical profession and the general public, first published by the U.S. Senate and later republished in numerous periodicals and professional journals, in which a surgeon named Robert Bartholow claimed that the sexual depravities of Mormonism resulted in a whole host of readily visible physical deformities. The Mormon countenance, according to Dr. Bartholow, was compounded of sensuality, cunning, suspicion, and a smirking self-conceit. The yellow, sunken, cadaverous visage, the greenish-colored eyes, the thick, protuberant lip, the low forehead, the light, yellowish hair, and the lank, angular person constitute an appearance so characteristic of the new race, the production of polygamy, as to distinguish them at a glance. Brigham rebutted such criticism, at least on some occasions, with the counterintuitive argument that plural marriage was actually an antidote to immorality, because men with a multitude of wives wouldn't be tempted to engage in adulterous liaisons or visit prostitutes. Other times he maintained that polygamy actually had nothing to do with sexual gratification whatsoever. God never introduced the patriarchal order of marriage with a view to please man in his carnal desires, Brigham insisted. He introduced it for the express purpose of raising up to his name a royal priesthood, a peculiar people. The Mormon leader insisted as well that the marital customs of the saints were a religious freedom protected by the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. The rest of the country, he thundered, had no right to require the residents of Deseret to abandon one of their most sacred religious doctrines. If we introduce the practice of polygamy, it is not their prerogative to meddle with it. The fact that polygamy was a felony everywhere else in the Union did not impress Brigham. In his view, the laws of God took precedence over the laws of men, particularly the laws of Gentile men. To this end, in Deseret, the saints installed a legal system of their own singular design, which very cleverly ensured that whenever the two bodies of law clashed, God's laws would prevail. Because Utah remained a territory rather than a state, legal power was supposed to reside in the federal courts. The Utah Territorial Legislature, dominated by Mormons, got around this insufferable insult by radically expanding the powers of the local probate courts, which Brigham controlled, thereby usurping the jurisdiction of the federal government. Most probate judges were Mormon bishops, and the juries who assembled in their courtrooms were made up almost entirely of good Mormons who obediently based their verdicts on instructions received from church leaders. Federal officials dispatched to Utah to ride herd over the saints were aghast by what they witnessed and complained to their superiors in Washington that Brigham had transformed the territory into a theocratic dictatorship. But the majority of these Gentile officials, many of whom were corrupt to the core and had come to Utah intending to enrich themselves on graft, faced such unrelenting harassment that all but two of them eventually fled Utah altogether, fearing that if they stayed they would receive an unannounced visit from Porter Rockwell and turn up dead, which in fact happened to an undocumented number of federal agents. A rising chorus of non-Mormon voices declared Brigham to be a dangerous tyrant who wielded absolute power over his followers. One Gentile visitor warned that on the face of the whole earth there is not another people to be found, so completely under the control of one man. Brigham was unmoved. As far back as 1851, he had blustered that any president of the United States who lifts his finger against this people shall die an untimely death and go to hell. 5 years later, he was no less ornery, declaring that he intended to make Utah a sovereign state in the Union, or an independent nation by ourselves, and let them drive us from this place if they can. They cannot do it. Such rhetoric, on top of ever more numerous reports of Mormon belligerence, alarmed the rest of the nation. The more Washington tried to rein Brigham in, however, the more brazen his insubordination became. In March 1857, shortly after James Buchanan was inaugurated as president, the Utah Territorial Legislature sent a truculent missive to Washington, announcing that the Saints would ignore any and all federal statutes they determined to be unjust, and would expel from their midst any federal officers who didn't meet the rigorous moral standards of the Mormon Church. It proved to be bad timing on the part of the Saints. Utah Territory was an annoying problem for the new leader of the nation, but compared to other national problems then looming, it was a relatively small one, which President Buchanan thought he could handle quickly and easily. And in the Mormon insurrection, he saw a means to distract Americans from much larger, much less tractable issues. The increasingly divisive rancor over slavery, for instance, which was threatening to tear the country to tatters. As a pro-slavery Democrat, Buchanan figured that by coming down hard on pro-slavery Utah, he could gain favor with abolitionists without having to sacrifice much political capital, because the Mormons were so widely reviled. So he followed the counsel of lawyer Robert Tyler, the son of former President John Tyler, and an influential operative within the Democratic Party, who urged him to supersede the Negro mania with the almost universal excitements of an anti-Mormon crusade. Although Joseph Smith had been opposed to slavery on moral grounds, in 1836 he'd even ordained an African-American man, Elijah Abel, as an elder in the Mormon priesthood, Brigham Young was an unapologetic racist, as were a great many other 19th-century Americans, whose interpretations of Scripture institutionalized racism within the LDS Church. Under his leadership, Utah became a slave territory, and the Mormon Church supported the aims of the Confederacy during the Civil War. Brigham's lasting impact on LDS doctrine made blacks feel exceedingly unwelcome in the church until more than a century after his death. Throughout most of the 20th century, African Americans were strictly banned from the priesthood, and black-white marriages were considered an outrage against God. Then in 1978, President Spencer W. Kimball had a revelation in which the Lord commanded that the LDS priesthood be open to males of all races, initiating a slow but profound shift in Mormon attitudes about race. In February 2002, the student body of Brigham Young University, though only 0.7% African American, elected a black man, Rob Foster, as their president, the first black student president in the school's history. Given the strongly held views of BYU's namesake, Foster's victory was regarded as an especially potent symbol. Launching a nice little war to divert national attention was a gambit no less appealing to 19th-century politicians than it is to their present-day counterparts. As historian Will Bagley noted, of all the complex difficulties facing the new administration, the Mormon problem offered the most tempting political opportunity and promised the most beguiling of solutions. Military action, a course that might unify the nation in a popular crusade against the evils of Mormonism. Alleging that the Mormons had committed a long list of treasonous acts, in May 1857 Buchanan dispatched a contingent of federal officials to restore the rule of law in Utah, including a new territorial governor to replace Brigham Young. More ominously, the new president ordered 2,500 heavily armed soldiers to escort these officials into Salt Lake City and subdue the Saints if necessary. For all intents and purposes, the United States had declared war on the Mormons. The Utah War, as it was known, has been compared by more than one historian to a comic opera. As Leonard Arrington and Davis Bitten wrote in The Mormon Experience, A History of the Latter-day Saints, the President of the United States had dispatched the largest peacetime army in the nation's history to oversee the installation of half a dozen officials in a minor territory. It turned out to be a war that generated much more smoke than heat, and a concord was ultimately negotiated before the Saints and American soldiers exchanged a single shot. The amicable resolution came too late, however, for members of a Gentile wagon train traveling to California through a lovely valley in Utah's remote southwest corner, high on the rim of the Great Basin. This bucolic sanctuary, named the Mountain Meadow, is now synonymous with one of the most chilling episodes in the history of the American West, an episode that exemplified the fanaticism and concomitant brutality of a culture that would be so enthusiastically idealized a century later by Dan Lafferty and his fundamentalist brethren. Chapter 18. For Water Will Not Do. Mormons were different because they said they were different, and because their claims, frequently advanced in the most obnoxious way possible, prompted others to agree and treat them as such. The notion of Mormon difference, that is, was a deliberate invention elaborated over time. It was both cause and result of a conflict in which all parties discovered reasons to stress not what Mormons had in common with other Americans, which was a great deal, but what they did not have in common. One result of the conflict was an ideology that sought to turn the self-advertised differences of the Mormons into a conspiracy against the American Republic. R. Lawrence Moore, Religious Outsiders and the Making of Americans. By the time it reached the uplands of southern Utah, 280 miles beyond Salt Lake City, the wagon train that would be known to history as the Fancher Party included some 130 emigrants, mostly from Arkansas, as well as 1,000 head of cattle and 200 horses. Although the wagon train took its name from 45-year-old Alexander Fancher, who headed one of the company's most prominent families, the Fancher Party was actually a loose affiliation of at least four distinct groups, including one led by Captain John T. Baker, hence the other name by which the wagon train was commonly known, the Baker-Fancher Party. Over the preceding weeks, a downtrodden assortment of backouts, apostate Mormons eager to leave the territory after acrimoniously quitting the church, had joined the Fancher group as well, swelling the company's ranks to approximately 140. This unusually large train, spread out along miles of the old Spanish Trail, the southern route to California, rolled into the Mountain Meadow over several hours on the evening of September 6, 1857, and the travelers stopped for the night beside a clear artesian spring. Although the valley seems originally to have been named the Mountain Meadow, most maps refer to it as the Mountain Meadows in the plural, and the slaughter that took place there is almost universally known as the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Their campsite was in the middle of a shallow valley, 5,800 feet above sea level, carpeted with lush green sedges and bunch grass gone to seed. Just beyond this high oasis on the edge of the Great Basin, the trail dropped sharply down into the scorching wastes of the Mojave Desert. Given the hundreds of miles of hot, hard country that stretched ahead of them, the emigrants must have been grateful for the opportunity to rest and graze their stock in such a verdant setting. The temperature dipped into the 40s when the sun went down. At daybreak, after rousing themselves from their bedrolls, the group huddled around campfires to warm their hands and to cook. The crisp morning air smelled of sagebrush and juniper smoke. No one suspected they were about to be attacked. The Arkansans hadn't even bothered to circle their wagons the night before, as they customarily did on the trail. Our party was just sitting down to a breakfast of quail and cottontail rabbits when a shot rang out from a nearby gully, Sarah Frances Baker Mitchell recalled 82 years after the event, and one of the children toppled over, hit by the bullet. That first gunshot was the beginning of a furious surprise assault that would fatally wound 7 Arkansans before the day was out. Although Mitchell was only 3 years old at the time, the horrors of that morning, and the even greater horrors of the week to come, were seared into her memory. The emigrants quickly circled their wagons into a defensive corral, dug in as best they could, and returned fire, repelling the first wave of assailants. They assumed they were being ambushed by Indians, a conjecture that seemed to be confirmed by glimpses of dark-skinned men in war paint shooting at them. As it happened, most of the attackers on that initial morning of what would become a 5-day siege were indeed Paiutes, but others were Mormons from nearby settlements who had simply painted their faces to look like Indians. And commanding the assault was a well-known Latter-day Saint, 44-year-old John D. Lee, a battle-tested veteran of the Troubles in Missouri and Illinois, as devoted to the church and its leaders as any Mormon alive. Although Lee was a blustery, brown-nosing martinet beloved by few of his peers, Brigham Young felt genuine affection for him and valued his unfaltering obedience. Back in Nauvoo, shortly after assuming leadership of the church, Brigham had adopted him in an esoteric Mormon ritual, making Lee his symbolic son, and in 1856 he'd appointed Lee Farmer to the Indians, the prophet's personal ambassador to the southern Paiute tribe. To comprehend why Lee, an American citizen, would be leading an attack on an American wagon train, one has to look back to the beginning of that summer and consider the shock waves of panic and fury that roiled Deseret when word arrived that a hostile army was amassing to the east. Porter Rockwell was carrying a load of mail from Utah to Missouri when he learned of the impending American military action against the Saints. Near what is now the eastern border of Wyoming, he encountered the mayor of Great Salt Lake City, as the capital of Utah was then known, his friend Abraham Smoot, who was headed west with a herd of cattle. Smoot told Rockwell that the Mormons' mail contract with the U.S. postmaster had been abruptly canceled, and that federal troops were mustering at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, with orders to march on the Kingdom of God. Rockwell immediately turned around and, accompanied by Smoot and two other companions, headed back to Utah to alert Brigham. Pausing at Fort Laramie, the destroying angel hitched a buckboard to the two fastest horses in the Mormon corral, then drove the animals hard all the way to Great Salt Lake, making the 513-mile trip in just over 5 days. On July 24th, Pioneer Day, Rockwell and Smoot told Brigham of the coming invasion just as the Saints were kicking off a huge celebration to mark the 10th anniversary of their arrival in Zion. Brigham announced the electrifying news to the Pioneer Day gathering just after sunset. The crowd reeled, reacting with a mix of confusion, apprehension, and rage. Standing before 2,500 of his subjects, Brigham assured them that they need not fear the army of the United States, for the Saints were sure to prevail. "We have borne enough of their oppression and hellish abuse," he bellowed, "and we will not bear any more of it. In the name of Israel's God, we ask no odds of them." The Commonwealth of the Latter-day Saints, he brashly declared, henceforth constituted a new and independent state to be known no longer as Utah, but by their own Mormon name of Deseret. Brigham had actually been aware for more than a month that federal troops were en route to Utah, but had withheld the news until Pioneer Day for maximum dramatic effect. For the better part of a year, in fact, he'd been stockpiling arms and drilling his crack militia, the Nauvoo Legion. After the Pioneer Day announcement, he simply accelerated preparations for the defense of Deseret. "And the cornerstone of this defense," says historian Will Bagley, "was to rally Utah's Indians to the Mormon cause." The inspiration for Brigham's military strategy came directly from Mormon scripture. According to the Book of Mormon, the Indians of North America were descended from the Lamanites, and as such they were remnants of the same ancient tribe of Israel to which Nephi, Mormon, and Moroni had belonged. The Lamanites, of course, had rejected the teachings of Jesus, waged war on the Nephites, and eventually killed every last one of them, crimes that had resulted in God cursing the Lamanites with dark skin. Scripture nevertheless taught that the Lamanites slash Indians would once again become a white and delightsome people when, during the last days before the return of Christ, the Latter-day Saints converted them to Mormonism. The Book of Mormon indeed prophesied that the Lamanites, once redeemed, would join forces with the Mormons to vanquish the Gentiles and thereby usher in the great and dreadful day of the Lord. This momentous alliance between Mormon and Lamanite, Brigham was certain, was about to become a reality, paving the way for the Second Coming. He had reached this conclusion as soon as the Saints had arrived in the Great Salt Lake Valley, when he'd realized that the Mormons' new homeland was in the midst of the Lamanites. God's plan seemed to be unfolding just as it had been prophesied in the Book of Mormon. It hadn't occurred to Brigham, though, that the Lamanites might balk at playing their divinely ordained role. The Indians were sometimes willing to act as mercenaries and attack Merikats on behalf of the Mormonee in return for a share of the plunder, but they never considered the Saints to be their allies. Indians made a clear distinction between Mormons, whom they called Mormonee, and other Americans, referred to in the phonetic rendering of the Paiutes as Merikats. The Indians regarded the big captain and the rest of the Mormonee as merely the lesser of two hideous evils, and sometimes not even that. Despite the Indians' lack of enthusiasm for fulfilling their prophetic calling, Brigham used every means at his disposal to enlist them in his campaign against the Gentiles. And when the spoils were sufficiently enticing, the Indians obliged. Numerous Gentile emigrants passing through Utah reported that their horses and cattle were driven off by Indian raiders, only to show up later in Mormon corrals. If the Indians fell short of the saints' millennial expectations that they would function as the battle axe of the